This is a No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and today I'm joined by Mark Eisenberg, a Microsoft account manager and a self-described cloud visionary. Thank you very much for joining me, Mark.
Glad to be here.
And welcome back. This is your second time on the podcast. So for people who didn't hear our first podcast, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I've been in the industry for over 30 years. Left software development full-time, actually, way back at the end of the 80s. I got tired of, how did I used to put it? I said I made less people making more money than me who weren't as smart as me, making promises that I had to work weekends to live up to. So an opportunity came along to join Intel's channel at that time, and I learned a lot about, you know, interacting with customers from them. And I just, it took me all the way to 2006 to finally make the transition into Microsoft. And then a few years later, I got bitten by the cloud bug when I got onto the Azure sales team, and I have never looked back. Left Microsoft for a couple years, did some time in New York with a consulting firm, and then was recruited back in 2014, where I support customers who not only are doing Azure work, but are actually doing a lot of legacy work as well. So this topic that we have today is kind of front and center for them.
Just before we move on to that, I think you still do a little bit of programming yourself. Am I right about that?
Yes, I call that keeping my hands dirty.
Okay, so you are not completely disconnected.
Right. The way I describe it is I need to know if I'm lying to the customers or not.
So what we are going to talk about today for the rest of the podcast are software monoliths. We're going to kind of go through the whole thing. So to start off, what is the monolith? Because we keep hearing about it from a lot of people.
Yeah, the way I've been boiling it down these days, kind of visually, is like it's any piece of code, any system, a software system where you can't pull on it over here, pull a string over here, and have 10 bells ring in completely what you thought were unassociated places. So the more formal way to put that is very tight dependency coupling, making it very, very difficult to, you know, maintain the code. And more importantly, in this day and age with increasing business speed, to be able to adapt to the needs of the business at any kind of meaningful pace. Because when you try to do big things as business changes, you try to do any kind of significant change to the code, you wind up breaking it, you know, because of all of the dependencies and the thing that you didn't even know you were touching while you're trying to, you know, add functionality.
If you have, let's say, an application and you're a software developer and you're looking at it, what are some of the telltale signs that it's a monolith for someone who's, let's say, new to the industry?
That's a very good question. I hadn't actually thought of that kind of description. Remember last time I think I brought up the definition of pornography, right? You know it when you see it.
Okay.
Well, that was from a Supreme Court case. That's why I went into the whole story back then. It's not just that you have lots of different components, but one real telltale is when components know each other, when they know about each other, you haven't really achieved any level of decoupling. And that's a key. We use loose coupling or decoupling or whatever, you know, to talk about this. And we've been trying, even when we were coming up with the new forms of higher level languages in the 70s, you know, one of the attempts there was to encapsulate functionality. Remember, that was a big word in object-oriented programming, and we really wanted to you know, contain that code so that, you know, that was its own little world. And we took that same kind of concept into the surface-oriented world as well, but then we did bad things. So, you know, we another thing that I just recently kind of came up with is this idea that no matter what we're doing, whether it was web services or, you know, kind of combined with SOA or, you know, now microservices, you see the interface between all these functions looks just like a Fortran procedure call or a Fortran function call. There's no difference. It's like you get to a point, you call something by name, it's got parameters, and you wait for a result to come back. Yes, we can do that asynchronously, but then sometimes that introduces more problems than it solves. So that's another indicator that you really are you're still in monolithic land when you're that's the way your code is functioning, regardless of its organization.
And our monoliths, let's say, how we started with large applications.
Yeah, you know, 30, absolutely.
40 years ago.
And they existed more. they existed for a very good reason. There really wasn't any choice. We had machines that were very powerful, and I kind of dated to the launch of the 360, the IBM 360 in 1965.
Well, that's a mainframe?
That's a mainframe.
Okay.
Yeah, that was we call it the first high-volume mainframe. And it came out, it had, by the standards of the day, a lot of resources. But by the standards of software need, it was still very resource constrained. And you needed to pack as much functionality into as small a space as possible. And you don't get to do elegant things when that's what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, it's a science. We saw another example of that in the 90s. If you remember the Phoenix BIOS, it was the not IBM BIOS that everybody was using. And then American Megatrends built a BIOS. And one of the things is they got it into a smaller footprint because memory, you know, flash memory was very expensive at the time. And they used all kinds of things to make it smaller. It also meant that nobody else could understand it. I mean, I'd seen pieces of that code at one point, and it was very, very tight, and it was very, very monolithic. And so that's another example of what you do when you're trying to deal with resource constraints.
We hear a lot about, you know, three-tier applications and monoliths, sometimes maybe used interchangeably. What is the relationship between a three-tier or an N-tier and monoliths?
So what I will say, in all seriousness, is that the N-tier application was the 1980s attempt to solve the challenge of monoliths. So that's another aspect of we didn't actually touch on that yet, and why I've been thinking about this lately. Monoliths were created in we'll put a stake in the ground. We'll say the mid 60s.
Sure.
Probably by about 1970, we were trying to solve that problem.
That's soon.
And we introduced, absolutely. Because the business problem that goes with it, the lack of agility, one of our favorite words nowadays, it was manifesting very quickly. In the late 70s, when I was in college, it seemed very glamorous to be an operator on a mainframe. If you ever saw one in the big raised floor room with all the machines opening and closing themselves, it all seemed glamorous. So I got myself a job for like 2 months. I lasted being an operator on a 370 that we had at the time at the university. And one of the things that it ran was a piece of code from the early 50s that was written from an even earlier generation of IBM mainframe that was so delicate but so critical to the university. They just kept running the same piece of code.
And sounds like good reuse to me.
Yeah, right, exactly. Except then there were these abends that kept happening, which was IBM speak for abnormal end. Okay,
so
because
this is
the
like
emulator,
an exception?
Right? The emulator for the 1401 mainframe would keep crashing. So this was not an ideal way to do it, but the business leadership understood that it would be a massive project to rebuild. This was the registration system for the university. So to rebuild that from scratch was just too massive because it was a monolith. That's really what it comes down to. Okay. The intestinal fortitude to start over doesn't really exist in our business. It's very rare. If somebody has a new idea, you start from scratch. But if you've got something that's more or less working to justify the millions of dollars that it takes to rebuild it from scratch, it just doesn't happen very often. There needs to be some other compelling event that's making that happen. Even Y2K didn't make us start over. You know, we just went and figured out how to plug all the holes in it, and we kept going for a while. I think since the 70s, and we did it with a variety of different programming language paradigms, you know, as we went from, well, assembly language and a lot of them, I think we came up, IBM had PL1, there was ALGOL, which was the algorithmic language. So that was a way that was very focused on algorithms. I think Lisp may go back that far. And so it was one language after another. When I was getting into all of this, we were learning Fortran and BASIC, which were kind of like, you know, the core of the evil empire of building monolithic applications. BASIC at the time when I learned it only had global variables. They didn't even have a way to partition in BASIC. Fortran, at least you could partition. And Pascal was coming along, and that was a modular programming language that that would let you split it up. And then Ada, which was an experiment that, well, actually it's still out there. I shouldn't call it an experiment. The Defense Department wanted a language that was going to solve this whole reusability and monolithic challenge that they had. And then when we got to the 80s, we were starting to get into architectural solutions to these problems. And so the three-tier or N-tier problem came along. And it's interesting you bring it up, because when I was doing my cloud presentation several years ago, part of it I would talk about is that we would do the N-tier application, which the tiers were supposed to be loosely coupled. In principle, you could slide the data tier out and plug a whole new data tier in, because they were all supposed to be loosely coupled. They were supposed to be insulated. And I said, instead, what we did is we took big steel straps, wrapped it around all three layers, and pulled them tight. And I've talked to customers actually in my cloud role, not in this role, where they were literally running point-to-point WCF connections between the tiers. They had no way to scale it, no way to sever that. I actually do have a client right now who's running, it's a mobile application. It's all using named pipes, lots of them, and they're very chatty name pipes. And so this is just not a loosely coupled kind of behavior. So they have very much monolithic behavior going on here. They can't touch it because things break all the time. So that's what I would say about N-tier, is that it was a mid-range in time attempt to solve the problem of the monolith.
But do you think it did solve it for anyone? Because to your exact point, I remember when I was learning C-sharp, and .NET, there was all this talk about being able to swap out the database. You have this provider and that provider, they've got the same interface, so you could in theory go from Microsoft SQL to Oracle, but no one ever does that. You're not going to willy-nilly just change the provider and continue on the next day, because there's a massive amount of work in it. So did we see the tiers ever really coming, all right, I'm going to take this one out, put that one in, use it over here, swap it the next week or the next month or the next year? No, I'm being a little exaggerating, but did N-tier achieve that for many companies?
So I have to be honest, I have never seen it done. Mm-hmm. That does not mean it hasn't been done.
Sure.
Almost every one of the epics in this timeline that we're discussing here of different solutions to the problem of the monolith, when applied by a sufficiently committed team, could deliver that result. I suspect, and would be my opinion, that very few organizations, if any, actually achieve that level of loose coupling.
What are, let's say, the disadvantages of the monolith that, as we see them now? Because, for a long, long time, we didn't even refer to it as a monolith. We just called it software.
And is that true?
I think we were happy for a long time. I think the
thought goal... I'd been hearing this monolith term for a long time.
Sure, but I think people were happy. Well, they weren't using it in a disparaging way. Let's
got
say.
It. Okay,
it was
although
okay,
the word itself seems kind of disparaging.
I know,
it?
But we didn't go around let's go deploy our monolith on these 36 servers. It was let's deploy our application. Our N-tier application. So there must have been advantages. What would you say were the advantages of the monolith?
People knew it.
Okay.
People know how to do it. I think that's still, in my day-to-day world, at Microsoft, I have conversations that basically come down to, we're doing it this way because we know how to do it this way.
Yeah.
And we don't have the skills to take the risk to move off of it. Somebody shared an article with me recently about microservices, and two of the core tenets of it was actually, I think it was called Stop the Microservice Madness. And the core of it, two of the core tenets in there were you know, the skill sets are rare, and, you know, and it's hard to hire those people. That's what it comes down to. So I think with the monolith, in fact, I went through the, when my, my own son, who's now in his 30s, he, when he was in college, he took a Java programming class. Java is, you know, one of the very core object-oriented programs we have. They taught him procedural programming first. They actually break these kids before they try to teach them it right. And the skill set, and then I'm told the reason that is this is the skill sets that the hiring corporations want, that they need. Why? Because they're maintaining monoliths. So it's this cycle that's going around and around. The code exists. The code needs to be maintained. The code needs to be extended. These are the skill sets you need. So we teach the younger people the same skill sets, and we're stuck in the cycle going around and around.
Yeah, because you're not going to find too many. You'll find plenty, but not every company that you're going to join will have you walk in and start adding a microservice, which will communicate in a decoupled way to another microservice.
Correct.
For a lot
Correct.
Of developers in, let's say, the Microsoft world, you know, if you're quite unlucky still, you're going to be working on Windows, or excuse me, web forms. And a lot of companies have moved to MVC or, you know, to web API, but very few have successfully moved to robust microservices.
Correct.
But to your point about skills, it's an interesting one. I was watching a presentation. It wasn't by Adrian Cockcroft, but he was referenced in it. And the opinion he expressed seemingly is, it's not that people don't have the skills, it's that the companies don't have the, let's say, the will to move that direction and to train people. And that quite often processes or business demands get in the way of allowing these people, allowing developers who may or may not already know microservices, but allowing them from developing towards microservices.
Yeah. So beforehand, you and I had a chat about the visionary term and whether we would use it or not and why I like it.
you're referring to you.
Yeah, yeah, referring to me. But it's more general than that. In order to affect change, you need a visionary. We encourage that, kind of the same point that you're making here about encouraging developers to try out new things. So even if the visionaries are there, they're not nurtured. They kind of put down. And so I think a lot of the reason that a lot of this hasn't taken place is that you're right, you know, to follow on to your point, these people are not allowed to spread their wings and try new things, because then the R word, risk, mm-hmm. is introduced into the conversation. And it's like, do you want to put your career on the line for this? And since most of those people are lower down in the tier anyway, they're not really putting their careers on the line. It's whoever's up the line that's going to ultimately approve it. And, you know, I think, have I shared with you my joke about what CIO is an acronym for?
No, go ahead.
Career is over. Mm. And it's really a joke, obviously, but it's an indication that if a CIO comes in and he tries to affect change, there's risk. And there can be two outcomes there: failure, which is no good, or no change, which, if he spent a lot of money on the initiative, that's no good either. That's kind of like failure. And so he's done with that. He or she, I shouldn't be sexist.
Sure,
here.
But you're leaving out the possibility of success.
Right, but then if you look at why we keep reinventing, and there's what we call the new shiny object every few years, it's because these things are not delivering the results. It really is a big exercise in, hey, look over there. Because remember, SOA was going to save the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And SOA has not, enterprises are really no more agile in their development practices today than they, you know, were 10, 15 years ago when we started talking about SOA. And before that, there were NTier was going to fix all of the problems. Client server was going to fix all of the problems that we were dealing with. So the CIOs that came in and did that, they may get partial success and be able to declare victory and move on. But let's go back to that monolith word and why I've been talking about it these days. We've been having this monolith conversation for 5 decades. So, and you and I have discussed many times about microservices and what it would take for them to actually change it. Can they actually change it? A lot of people don't believe that they can solve the problem. My point now is, any of these things could have changed the game, but they didn't. why do we keep going through cycles of introducing something new? It is the latest shiny object. We all chase it for a couple, 3 years. Then, because there are no skills or no visionaries or no whatever, it doesn't happen, and we create another thing. And there are many of these things. If you want to take that continuum of web services and SOA and now microservices and web APIs and all of these terms that we're throwing around in various order, you know, they're all basically the same idea. You know, loose coupling, you know, partition the code, couple it loosely so that you can change things without affecting the entire system. And so my point now is with microservices, not that I am so passionate about microservices per se, but I think they can solve it. So why don't we put a stake in the ground and see if we can actually change the monolithic landscape using, you know, that technique.
So one thing I would imagine that people are probably wondering right now, because I am as well, is we have a lot of examples of good companies achieving a lot with microservices. Now, you know, I'm going to throw out the big names, the Netflixes, sure, the Microsofts, probably the Vistaprints, to give a local Boston example. So, and I'm sure a lot of small companies, because you and I both attend meetups and we hear from smaller companies that they have improved their process. You know, microservices are working for them, or, you know, it might not be the ideal scenario that someone writes a book about, but they've achieved a lot with it. You know, loose coupling, easier deployments, better testing, faster turnaround. Whereas what you're suggesting is that it hasn't worked. So is it that you're seeing companies that are failing at this, or is it that you think the whole industry is failing at this?
No, it's not the whole industry. The examples you give are good. They also have one characteristic in common. They were all small. I believe they all built monoliths. Constant Contact is another local one. Mm-hmm. I know I went to a presentation out there. And they built a monolith, and then the scale problem kicked in. So for their survival, they had to change what they were doing. I believe Netflix was up against the same thing. For their own survival, they had to change it. And because they were small enough, they still could. When I talk about it not working, and I look from Microsoft's point of view, where we make most of our money, what the nature of our customers. And it doesn't all have to be huge customers. A medium-sized customer is going to be pretty locked in to the way they're doing things at that point. If they're making money, you can't really mess with the software that is part of making money. And so when I say it hasn't worked, I engage my clients in these conversations about what do you want to do better? And they, you know, usually, so sometimes I've gotten blank stares, which is interesting. You know, this is like, what? They've never even thought about what they would like to do better. They're so busy in the trenches that doing something better is not even on it. But those who do have it, then we get into, let's take, for example, how microservices could. So let's hypothetically say they acknowledge that the monolith is not doing what they need. And they want to do, so like, let's take agility is a very good business. Agility is a good example that, you know, we've all heard, you know, IT cannot respond quickly enough and cost effectively enough for us to get the new business functionality which we need, which is why in the old days we used to stick things, a server under a desk, and nowadays we go out and sign up for a cloud account. But then you engage them in that conversation, and then what's happening is, well, we have to keep doing it the way we're doing it because of SOX, or we have to keep doing it the way we're doing it because of this, or we have to keep doing it because of that, or we can't change how we're doing it because we can't get people who will do that, et cetera. So it's the whole list of can'ts. Meanwhile, they're still being leaned on by the business to do what they're doing better than they're doing it. And then we get into, so then there's a very elegant dance you get into where you say you're doing the new thing. And let me give you an example, very specific with service orientation. Doesn't have to be microservices. Many, many service-oriented architectures use RPC to communicate between the services. RPC, remote procedure call. It's exactly the same technique you used when you were calling a procedure in PL1, you know, like I said, I alluded to it earlier, you know, there's a piece of code that needs to invoke another piece of code that happens to be running in another service. I will use this remote procedure call to invoke it. Well, that is inherently an extremely tightly coupled way of doing things, but I partitioned my architecture into services and I kept going, but I was able to reuse the skills that I already had. So, I have a fairly sweeping opinion that the techniques of the 60s are still largely here. Yes, we're doing a lot more of it. So I think without a lot of the things, I'll pick on VMware for a minute, you know, hyper or virtualization. If we had had to keep growing physical servers at the scale we're doing right now, that would just, it'd be impossible. So we do have tools that have managed, allow us to manage the complexity, but there's still so much more we could do to make this work better for the business than it does today.
But to your point about the remote procedure calls, so even if you are doing that, and even if you are, let's say, negative about that idea, it still has given you the ability to deploy independently and test independently, and you could scale, let's say, the service that maybe, I don't know, a ticketing service. You could have 100 of those and only 2 login services. And yes, fine, you still have your coupling, but you have independent scalability. So, you know, there are kind of graduations of improvement. This will help you. The next thing will help you. Yeah, maybe we're not at the, you haven't broken the monolith entirely, but you've achieved a lot.
I would agree with you. If I wasn't hearing the same complaints, both on the technical side and on the business side of these corporations. So I think you're correct. I think that they have allowed us to do certain things. Although I will say, I'll take as your example there, the independent deployments. In principle, you can do that. And in certain limited scenarios, you can do that. But the reality is when you have this tight coupling, the consumer and the producer, because they're tightly coupled, have to be deployed together. So the question, even though you're calling it remotely and it's maybe running on a different machine, does it really matter? Has it really changed the challenge that the monolith presents? You know, the problem wasn't really that we're running one piece of code on one machine instead of running one piece of code on 10 machines.
So when I was prepping for this discussion, I came across an article about Etsy, the kind of artistic eBay, let's say. And they have a big defense of monoliths. They have what they call are very talented engineers, very talented deployment, very good code, and they're happy with their monolith.
Okay. If it's working for them, stay with it.
So what would you think would be the difference between them achieving success with a monolith and a lot of companies failing with a monolith or struggling with a monolith?
They were small at one time. They assembled a team. This is my speculation. I don't know Etsy directly. Because they were born, I believe, in the dot-com bubble. So there was a lot of creative stuff that was going on at the time. If you get the right team building the right code with enough forethought, you can use any technique or no technique. It doesn't matter. It'll be a big piece of code. I mean, those of us who are good at writing code, there are things that we do instinctively. I've joked many times when I look at, you know, my clients will tell me, well, we're doing this. And the first thought I have is, why would you do that? And any experienced developer will react to it in that way. There are things that shouldn't be done. And if Etsy was able to build a team and create a product where they didn't do those things, then the monolith will work just fine. Because they had a lot of forethought on where they wanted the platform to go, where they needed it to go.
For a company that's, let's say, currently developing a monolith and they want to move off of it, what advice would you give? What steps to take? And so on.
Find a visionary. Same thing. I actually went to a DevOps conference last spring, I think. And that was one of the very clear messages there is that you need people to carry the torch for the idea of DevOps. in order to be successful in implementing DevOps. I will say the same thing about breaking the monolith and going to a service-oriented architecture. You need a core group that is empowered to lead the charge on it. And I've been in this position before. I left full-time development, and it was back in the 80s, and we were doing case. And I wound up being the evangelist for case in my company. And we did some really amazing things. I mean, we put a piece of code together using those tools. We had to stick debug statements into it because it was running so quietly and cleanly based on our design. We had to make sure it was actually working because it's just not how code normally runs. So again, if you have the visionary or the evangelist who can lead it and is empowered to lead it and empowered to make the cultural change. And I guess I would have to add on to that, you need executive air cover. You need leadership air cover. The leadership of the company has to commit. And there's a virtuous cycle there too, because the visionary is going to have to infect them with the belief that the problems that they have can be fixed by this this technique. And then one of the asks for them is to basically provide that air cover.
There's a book, and I've thought of it because you mentioned you need the visionary. There's a book by a guy called Simon Sinek called Start With Why. And he talks a lot about the technological movements, societal changes, large companies that have succeeded. And he talks about the need for the visionary who can advocate for something. And then along with that, you need the practical doers who will implement it. But you need both. You need that person who will get the support, who will be the natural leader. But that's tough for a company to just say, you know, you don't just put up a job rec saying, we need a visionary. Please apply.
Well, so a couple points on that, you probably have it within your company already. You just need to unchain them. You need to stop telling them that's not how we do it here. And you might catch from the edge of my voice that I'm very, very familiar with that concept. But let's go back to the Etsy thing you brought up a little bit. If it's working, it's interesting that Etsy feels compelled to defend what they're doing. But if it's working, why would you change it? So these other companies, they're trying to change. I mean, they were all going to the cloud before they had any idea what that meant. A lot of them are doing microservices now, and I can tell you point blank, most of them don't know what that means. It tends to be an exercise in small service-oriented architecture type of things. And then there were some gaps in even what SOA meant and what was important. And there are many, many layers to what it takes to build a service-based application today. So the company should ask itself, why are we trying to change? If what we're doing is good enough, why are we trying to change? And there should be, to your point about why, there should be a whole bunch of why we're trying to change. And then here's the ultimate why. Well, then why do you want to keep doing things the way you're doing them? Because in the end, and I've heard CIOs, I've heard it come, you know, right off their lips, we want to reuse our existing skills. And it took me years of hearing that before I finally realized what that means is, we want to keep doing what we already know how to do.
We don't want to change.
And the path to change, I mean, you say you need change. The path to change does not lie on that road.
No, but it's also very tough, as you say.
It was easy somewhere?
No. But it's I guess a lot of time it's the risk. But, you know, to repeat a well-trotted out phrase, no reward without risk or...
Right. And I wrote a piece, it was in Xconomy last spring, about what I'm calling the enterprise bang moment. One of the things that's very clear, even over just the last 15 years, is how fast the cycles are coming at us now. And competitive threats can rise up and destroy an established company very, very quickly before they have time to react. They've always had time. Historically, companies, when competition comes, you know, Polaroid was an excellent example, and Deca was actually another example of a company that they had a lot of time to react and chose not to. chose to disagree. And I was actually in Dex Channel at the same time I was doing the Intel thing. And it was interesting to watch as they finally kind of realized that they needed to change. But their industry was dead. The mini computer industry was already going over the cliff at that point, as New England knows better than most geographies. But that was simply a choice on their part to not react soon enough. Okay, and there's a cycle on that. But now that reaction time is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and sticking with software architectures that do not allow you to react to changing market conditions is not an awesome, you know, future-looking business model.
No. Yeah, you see it across industries. I'm seeing it in finance as well. You know, companies allowing you to put $5 into a 401k or savings brokerage account at a time. Much more companies involved in international currency transfers, taking the banks out of it. You know, they all will have to react to this, but the big banks can't necessarily react. But you're right, it is moving much, much faster. Mark, any final notes before we wrap up for today?
Nope, I think you got me revved up pretty well there. I do. Well, actually, that's enough. There is one thing, because I hear a lot of not in my world. And I'm getting up there. I got a few gray hairs at this point. I fundamentally believe this is not a law of nature. This stuff actually can be done way better. Microsoft, one of the reasons I am proud to work for Microsoft, as frustrating as it is to work for Microsoft, one of the reasons I'm proud to do that is because as a company, we have completely changed internally the way our products are delivered, you know, conceived of, delivered, updated. If you use any of our mobile apps, you know, they can be updated multiple times a week. And at first it was a little bumpy, but now it's a very smooth process. It can be done. But one of the things that Microsoft had going for it was people at the top who were basically saying this must happen. Even Ballmer, who took all the criticism for not getting it, he was the one who got behind Ray Ozzie, and he basically said, everything needs to be cloud ready, you know, within a certain period of time. And he pushed and he enabled, and you weren't able to do anything if it wasn't on the path to making our products cloud ready. So that wasn't meant to be an advertisement for Microsoft or anything like that. It was just, it is possible for a big traditional company to change how it does things. And so I happen to think that the transition off of monoliths and into microservices is a great place to start.
Well, on that very positive note, thank you very much for your time, Mark Eisenberg.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Sunrise from Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra by Kevin MacLeod.